and to remember to do so. Awesome. This is the Aries Working Group call, and we are glad you're here. Please be mindful of the antitrust policy and also the Hyperledger Code of Conduct link here. I will go ahead and paste the link in the chat. Please go ahead and join and add yourself to the attendees list if you wish other people to be able to contact you and find you. Announcements. BC Gov's looking for people to work on mobile agents. We have Aries RFCs and moved hypes. We're going to talk about that a little bit later today, a couple items down the list. Aries SDK repos have been created. Here's a link to the repos that exist. I would like to mention that there is code in at least one Aries repo now. We migrated the Indie SDK Python to Aries SDK Python with a couple of minor adjustments. So when we made that switch, it's not yet complete, but it's a start and it's something that's there. So we're excited about that. Also, there's an Aries SDK channel on Hyperledger. There's also an Aries maintainers channel on the Hyperledger Rocket Chat, which is used for sort of code maintenance type things and other maintenance tasks inside there. So you're very welcome to join the Aries maintainers channel if you would like. That's a whole lot of talking shop in there as we try to coordinate things, and you're welcome to join us and contribute your efforts. Is there anyone on the call today that has not previously been on the call and would like to introduce themselves? We've learned that if we wait till the end, it doesn't usually happen. Okay, if you would like to speak up later, please do. Something new that I would like to add is I would like to add a related meetings review. This helps those of us that don't attend all the other calls to be able to know what's actually going on in these other calls and that we might be aware of interesting topics that we might want to join those calls for. There's two on the list that I was going to add that I feel like are highly related. The first one I'm going to pick on is the JavaScript agent framework. Specifically, we're looking for like a 15-second review of what happened in that call. And anyone is allowed to do that. The organizer is useful, but anyone that was there and understands what was on the call, we'd love you to share a quick update about what happened. JavaScript agent framework call happened this week.
Sam, I really wanted to stay silent just so that you had to do it, but then you called me out by saying the organizer. So the premise of that was essentially I'm seeing a lot of need for a JavaScript style framework or something that is not just the base level primitive SDK. And so it was a kickoff discussion to try and get people started working on that, which will turn into something depending on the discussion later about naming. But essentially what it is how do we get people started on a JavaScript framework, and who is willing to contribute? So.
Awesome. Thank you, Kyle. Also related is the URSA project. The URSA is a crypto library within Hyperledger and relates to a bunch of the agent-y things that we're doing here. So is there anyone that was on the last URSA call? Nobody. That's okay. I would love to actually come up with a way in the wiki to automatically pull in notes or at least the brief review from the last meeting. That would be a useful thing to do. Are there any other calls that are meetings that are related that someone would like to report on that I have not listed here?
I think semantics might be an interesting one, but we didn't meet this week, so every other week we could report on that.
But don't you talk about everything on that call? I mean, isn't it all semantics?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been sitting on that joke for like a year. Man, I finally had a chance.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Anything you want to say about the semantics call?
Not this week. We didn't meet this week, so.
I'm going to call that Indie Semantics just to be more clear.
Yes, correct. Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. Is that a biweekly?
Yes, every other week. We meet next Tuesday.
On Tuesday, and that is the Hyperledger calendar is where you can find that. Any other meetings?
Is the JavaScript Agent Framework meeting intended to be weekly, bi-weekly, or just ad hoc?
It was just a one-time call in order to get people in the room and so that people know what people are working on. Follow-up for it will happen on the Aries SDK channel for now. And then also, if you're wanting to sign up as a maintainer, let either Daniel, myself, or Sam know so that we can get you added to the repository.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Awesome. The other thing that you can do, I create the meeting pages in advance of the meeting happening. I hope to a week in advance, but it's always within a couple of hours. And if you want to come add any announcements or links or anything to the page, you can, or even during the meeting, you're welcome to do so to help spread the word about something that's related. Okay, that sounds good. We will move on to our first topic of the day. Kyle is going to talk about and give us a demo of non-repeatable signatures. That's what the schedule says.
Awesome. I will go ahead and start out with the RFC. Can everybody see my screen still? I'm not sure if I did the right one. Oh, I didn't share. Okay. Desktop one. All right. So starting off, in the Aries RFC features section, there is a RFC that describes how this works. There's also a demo script built on in the SDK. I specifically, in 1.8.1, I built it in my indie dev.
Hello?
Kyle, we lost you.
We lost you for a second, Kyle.
Oh, okay. We'll just start over then. So there's a RFC 0066 that is in the Aries RFC features folder. There's also a demo.py, which I'm going to show today, just to kind of get an idea. But this is, if anybody wants to run it, it's an example of how you can use indie SDK today in order to use non-repeatable signatures. The thinking is that we will combine it into the pack and unpack API, which is a question that we have, but also create a separate API as well. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out mainly from people. Is how people want the APIs formatted. Quick overview, essentially what this is a way to handle non-repeatable signatures. So right now PAC is using authentication based upon repeatable authentication, which is authenticated encryption. And what we're looking to do is in certain cases, there's a need for non-repeatable signatures. So here's some examples. There's also been a RFC 0049 that's been written on this subject about non-repeatable versus repeatable. And essentially the thinking is that it should not be on by default, but we still need the implementation for the cryptographic envelope. So at a high level, that's what this is describing and doing. And there's some examples of how to do it while combining it with pack and unpack and stuff like that. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and run this demo. Can everybody see this? I don't know if my font can go. There we go. Okay, perfect. That might be too big. So what we're going to do here is just run this and just kind of show what the outputs are going to look like. So essentially what this is doing, it's a very quick script using indie SDK currently. That's going to go through and create some wallets, create some DIDs, create some keys. And then it's going to take that burr key and it's going to put that burr key inside the KID. And then it's also going to have a payload. So basically what I did is I took the basic message and I went and signed that using a non-repeatable signature. Normally you would not be signing basic messages, just as a clarification point. And then what I did is I base64 URL encoded this, which is the first part here, this Jose header. And then the second part is the base64 URL encoding of the payload here. And then you take that data and you actually go ahead and sign it. So I used the IndieSDK crypto sign function. And then I did the signature right there and concatenated it on top. Finally, what I was doing is I put it inside of a packed message. So I took this entire aspect or this entire JWS here, and I used that as the message, which was provided into the packed message format. And this was the final output. I was also concerned about size. So this is only 1.2 kilobytes in order to send that original message. I'm not sure what the inflation size is on that, but it is somewhat larger. And then finally, I ran through the unpack functionality. So at a very high level, essentially what I have a question for everybody is, would we prefer an API format? So I'm jumping over to a JavaScript implementation that I'm working on right now.
Hey, before we get to API formats, Kyle, I have a question.
Yep, go for it.
You take the signed message, and then you don't wrap it in anything else, right? That's the thing that you directly do, run into the pack and unpack functions?
Yes, this JWS right here. So
we're anticipating that pack will automatically detect that the thing it's unwrapping is in fact a signed message and automatically
unpack
that for you?
That
unpack will not only unpack the encrypted layer, but also the signature layer. Is that what we anticipate?
Yes. And the thinking on how that would work in terms of being able to identify that is in the unpack API, you would have an additional aspect into this JSON that is a Boolean true.
Something that's like signed or verified. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It'll say verified, and that will only be verified if the sender key that was used to encrypt the message, which is how the API will work, is the same as the key that was verified.
Right.
But how will it happen if it's not encrypted? Then it won't be able to do that test.
And that is by design. So this is because the only time that you should be using this other API, which is if it's not encrypted, is if it's signed content, which is trying to do the DID exchange protocol message. So we don't want unencrypted signed messages being sent other than the DID exchange protocol.
So what would the API call be for receiving, say, a signed connection invite? Is the application layer supposed to just identify that it's not encrypted and therefore it doesn't pass it to unpack and it just gives it to, I don't know, a verify method? Or are we looking for, is that what you're trying to say, Daniel? Looking for linearity? Yeah?
Well, you had brought up this notion of ephemeral mode before, and I think we've changed our mental model around the ephemeral mode a little bit, but I don't think that it's true that the only case we ever want to contemplate sending a signed but unencrypted message is in the DID exchange protocol. So that feels too narrow to me.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But you're saying, what do we do when I receive an unencrypted but signed DIDCOM message, what do I do with it? Do I pass it to a call like unpack that just gives me back the message and just strips away the JWT and maybe a sub-object in the result saying it was signed and verified by this person? Is that what you're sort of asking? Do we want unpack to just give back information from unencrypted messages as well and just like a wrapper object to tell you it wasn't encrypted, but it was signed by blah, blah?
So what I'm hearing based upon this description of the question Tobias asked, as well as what I'm hearing from Daniel, is that there would be value in having unpack handle all cryptographic envelope aspects.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm not sure that answers Daniel's concern, but I like the fact that no matter what I get, I can pass it in and then I'll get back the standard structure that says, hey, it was encrypted and here's how, hey, it was signed and here's how, and then here's the original message. So if I passed in even a message that had none of that, I'd still get back the same envelope that says, okay, it wasn't encrypted and it wasn't signed, but here's your message back. But there's a consistent way of processing those messages that places all of that evaluation logic inside of the unpack method, which I like.
Okay.
Does that get to what you were going after, Daniel?
I don't have a deep opinion about the form factor of the API. I haven't thought it through. You guys are more thoughtful about that side. I'm just saying that I think the ability to operate with signed but unencrypted is probably a little more important than just the marginal use case we've identified. And I would like to be able to operate that way. I want some clear instructions about how to do so.
I agree.
I want to know whether the signing that we're talking about here is repudiable or not.
Yes. The signing here is actually only non-repudiable addition. The repudiable authentication still happens through typical pack and unpack. So I'm not doing the HMAC signature.
Because you can't do repudiable, correct me if I'm wrong, you can't do repudiable signing if you don't have, if you're not encrypting to another audience, because the thing that makes authenticated encryption repudiable is they have to unpack it with their private key, don't they?
Right, when you're encrypting, then adding a signature on top should make, basically you're adding non-repudiation on top of the encryption that you're already doing.
Correct.
So the signature should be non-repudiable. When you're signing without encrypting, you're adding non-repudiation, but you're not encrypting. This is the case where you're trying to make some kind of public communication to an party, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm just double checking my understanding. This is great work, Kyle.
Thank you.
So
I think the branches, hey Kyle, just to summarize, is we've got encrypted, repudiable, non-repudiable, and unencrypted and non-repudiable, basically.
Yes.
So what you guys are pointing out to me in this conversation is that the aspects of repudiation and non-repudiation are very confusing, and expecting a general developer to have to understand what they're doing and understand the implications of it is the exact reason that I didn't want to separate APIs and do certain things and say, when you're doing this case, you got to do that. When you're doing that case, you got to do that and stuff. I would rather say pack and unpack everything unless it's an invitation message. And then all they have to do is
But what we're pointing out is I think it's pack and unpack everything unless you intentionally know that you're not. And the intentionally know that you're not comes into other types of communication that might be connectionless, to use the older term that we were using. And so I think we can get there by having the function call that actually does the signature be very explicit about what you're doing. In that way, it's clear that you are signing something but not encrypting it.
How do we feel in terms of having succinct APIs, how do we feel, and this is probably a question for everybody, about the pack functionality handling both encrypting or just not encrypting and just signing? So how do we feel about a single pack method for all messages, and whether or not we could get an API that would be intuitive enough?
I actually think we could, because I think you could have arguments, for example, for encryption that defaults to true, and you would have to explicitly say encrypted equals false if you wanted that to be the case. And then you could say non-repeatable signed true or false, and that one would default to false. And that way the defaults produce what we think people should be using most of the time for good security practices. But then the arguments make it very clear what you're opting into. If you say encrypted equals false, it's pretty hard to walk away with the feeling that that's going to be secure.
But you would just, like in your API, you would just omit your recipient keys, right?
I would make it more explicit than that.
Okay.
So that it's harder to make a mistake.
Okay, so Yeah, to me that API becomes less intuitive though, because then someone might feed in sender key, recipient keys, encrypted false, so recipient keys haven't been used in that API call.
API call should reject the parameters. Parameters don't match what they said. Yeah.
It's not uncommon to have, some arguments depend on the values of other arguments and to throw an exception if it's invalid. So that would be the direction that I would take to make it very explicit. I think that just omitting something is something you might do by mistake. Setting encrypted equals false is something you're unlikely to do by mistake.
So looking at the time, I just want to be conscious of this. If people would like to go discuss this, what I would suggest is jumping onto this issues channel or issue right here. The discussion has kind of already started, and that's how I ended up on the direction based upon what Sam was suggesting here. And so if we want to continue this, my suggestion is move it over to here, and then I can kind of work through it so that we can...
Kyle, that's a fantastic suggestion. Yes.
Okay.
Good.
I will stop sharing.
Kyle, thank you for that. That's excellent. And we'll join the discussion over there after the call. Next up, we have a more discussion on the IndyCatalyst agent as the new Aries code base by Stephen Curran and crew.
Hey, how are we doing? You can hear me.
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
Okay, so I'm going to do just a brief introduction and touch on the one of the main issues that's outstanding. So this is the same presentation that I did last week. I did just add a couple of slides to it, so I'll hit those. The main discussion from last week centered around this, so I revised this slightly. So do we call this Aries Python or Aries Agent Python? My leaning was this, but I think everyone else has either landed on I don't care or this. And so I think we go with this. Does anyone want to talk further about this topic?
Yeah, I think we should take about 10 minutes to talk about the order of the words.
The order of the words is defined. That goes away. So, yeah, nice try, Drummond.
Hey, look, I'm standing in a beautiful bike shed down in Denver, so I figured I might as well bike shed it. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. So I think we'll go with that. Aries Agent Python is what it will be. Other than that, the two things I wanted to bring up, we saw this last week, the sort of two parts. The IndyCat agent, which is sort of a thing you deploy as a single package. You don't really code to it much. There are some externalized elements that you might develop, and we're going to actually demo that today. And then you've got the agent controller, which is basically where the personality of a specific instance of an agent winds up. So the business logic, whether that be, you know, a UI or ties to a legacy system. I wanted to add this to it, which is this presentation. This shows sort of the RFCs that are either concepts over on this side or features on this side that are supported in IndyCat Agent as it stands today. So these things are all sort of covered in what we've got in place in the code base. So you can review that either, you know, at your leisure associated with this presentation. There's also a few demos in it, and we're starting to build those up more, but just so you can see them, there's the Catalyst demo, which is Agent Book. There's an Alice Faber interactive demo at the command line embedded within it. And a couple of other things related to that. So one of the things we've got to do is add more documentation, and we're doing that now, and that's probably the hardest part about moving this over into something that anyone can use. So we're working hard on that so we can push this over as quickly as possible. Any other comments or questions right now based on the discussions last week or anything else people want to ask? Okay, that was
I have a burning question.
Yes.
How soon can you have it in there?
We're working on it. So Nick is about to do a demo.
Hey, I have one more question before we get there.
Okay. Yeah.
The security model, as I believe in the code right now, relies on network level security for the admin REST interface.
Correct.
It
depends on whatever is in your deployment scenario. So you remember that a controller and an agent are always paired because you've got to have the thing that injects the business logic into it, and they have to communicate directly. So the idea would be that, you know, in our world, we're deploying them both to OpenShift, and there's a whole lot of mechanisms, including extra layers we've built on OpenShift to provide that. Regardless, if you're going to talk to a legacy system, so pretty much any cloud scenario is going to have that. But we also have done one where we actually, within a container, are basically talking to the REST interface almost directly. I'm not quite sure how that works, but the Alice demo does not actually spin up two separate containers, but actually has both the agent and the controller in the same container so that there's no external piece to it. So there's a lot of options there, but go ahead, Sam.
So my only concern is that we don't end up with an accidental security hole because someone didn't understand the nature of the deployment. So I don't know that I care which particular answer we have, but I think I would feel a lot more comfortable if this more or less was off by default or secure by default, and then you had to take steps to open it up so that it's harder to make an accidental security problem. What I really don't want to have happen is have someone check out the code, not understand the factors for deployment just because of an oversight or something else, and end up causing a huge, gigantic security vulnerability and have ARIES all over the news in a really bad way.
Gotcha.
So I don't know what the answer there is, but I feel like the right application of training wheels in some way would, in this particular case, would help alleviate some potentially bad problem like that.
Okay, I don't have an answer off the bat, but we'll talk through it and figure it out.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm fairly opinionated about this, but it was rather tangential, so I didn't bring it up. But just whenever you're discussing that later, can you involve me in that?
Sure.
And again, I think there's a variety of solutions we could approach, and I'm probably going to be fine with all of them. But I think that having a little bit more protection there to make it harder to accidentally deploy this in an insecure way would be good.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That was my other comment.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Nick, who developed a chunk of it. We've got a second demo that we're going to use for that Andrew's going to provide in a bit. So with that, I'll try to figure out where I lost my share button to. Stop sharing and turn it over to Nick.
All right. So some of you may have seen this before. Some of you may not have, so I'll just run through it quickly. So this is the Indie Catalyst Agent admin API. It has a Swagger interface on it, so it's kind of self-documenting. Most of these right now, these are all kind of protocols or message families. Most of these are provided out of the box. Once you install the agent, these are available by default. I think, you know, eventually these might split out into separate packages, but for now it's just provided with the install. So without going into too much detail, essentially you would, I guess, the controller is the one that utilizes this admin interface. So a controller being like some sort of web application. So in our case, it's like an issuer service or the org book. When it wants to form connections with other agents or other services that have agents, it instructs its agent via this admin API to form a connection, for instance, and then issue credentials and so on. So to do that, it's pretty straightforward. You'd call connections, create invitation. You get back this payload. And I have two agents running. So I can receive the invitation on the other side. And that was successful. If I query all of my connections, so I'm calling get connections. I've got a list of results here. Several connections, I've done this before already today, but each connection has an internal ID. And then most things that you're doing is over a connection. And so you provide this connection ID for whatever you're doing. So if you're issuing a credential or kicking off that process, you would provide this connection ID for the connection that you want to issue that credential to. And you know, here all the DIDs are pairwise. So right, I've got their DID and my DID. On the other end, that's going to be the inverse. So that's kind of generally how the admin API works. The piece that we just wrapped up last week was the ability to provide your own external like modules for a protocol as well as this admin endpoint. So this issuer registration, So this is an endpoint. So with the org book, we have a use case where we need to be able to have an issuer that registers itself with the org book. And for those of you who haven't heard of that, that's kind of a multi-subject holder that we have. It's kind of our primary use case for using verifiable credentials. But it's kind of this registry for a whole bunch of credentials, and it holds millions of credentials. And so whenever an issuer, before it can issue credentials to the org book, it needs to register itself and it needs to send its information. So we've got like a logo and an email address and a URL and that kind of stuff. But then also the credentials that the org book receives, the issuer actually instructs the org book how to process the credentials. So when the org book receives the credentials, it actually kind of post-processes the credentials after it's been stored in the wallet and then stores other information related to that credential in its kind of application database to drive the UI. But anyways, this particular protocol was actually loaded by simply running pip install. So in our case, it's the Python ecosystem, right? So you do pip install. You know, I'm installing out of GitHub right now, but this could easily also just be available in the Python package index. And once you do that, then the external module is just loaded via this protocol command line parameter. So this is how you run the Indie Catalyst agent. Everything's kind of provided in command line arguments. And so I've said, you know, oh, and also load this external protocol module called Indie Catalyst issuer registration. And that's just a Python module that's available in the Python path because it was installed via pip. And once, you know, once that has been done, then, you know, it adds this admin interface. So it's one URL or endpoint, but it could also be as many as you like. And then also, of course, the internal DIDCOMs or agent messages, the handlers for those. So to actually send the message over DIDCOMs, you can do that as well. So if I just show that quickly.
Nick, there's no S.
DIDCOM, right.
Thank you.
So the new connection that I've just formed here, I got back this internal connection ID. So if I say, oh, I want to send this to this connection. You know, this connection has been formed already. And then I provide also whatever else is required for this particular message. It's got a bunch of kind of example data there. And if I hit send, that's successful. You know, if I look down here, not a whole lot of logging enabled right now, but you can see that you know, the connections are being used to send that message across as a DIDCOM message. So I think that's all you wanted to show off, right?
I think so.
Okay.
Anyone have any questions about that?
I'm repeating my other question. How soon can you have it?
We're getting there. I did notice that action menu is already in as a core one, so we should probably put it in as an external one until we get, or at least we should propose an RFC. So we'll work on that one.
Yeah, and you know, in theory, this could be, you know, all of the indie specific protocols, you know, those could be, you know, an indie package that you could install, and all of a sudden you just have this group of message families that are the indie message families. The same can be true for UPort or whatever. So it's all the architecture is quite pluggable and modular. The goal is that you can kind of plug in whatever you want and use that.
One other thing I'd like to point out is with this idea of, you know, IndyCat agent and the controller can be any language you want. It does not have to be Python. So, you know, when we did email verification service in the IIW book, those two services were both built as controllers talking to instances of IndyCat agent. Those were both done as Django web apps, but there's no reason they had to be. We could have done them as Java.
As long as you can.
Node.js, we could have done anything as long as we can call them.
Yeah, you just have to be able to call, you know, a REST interface, you know, HTTP, and then you receive webhooks back for state changes. And as long as you can do that, then the controller can be whatever you want.
Okay, there's one more thing I wanted to highlight. If you could go to send. I find this one to be an interesting one when Nick showed this to me, and I wanted to highlight it, which is when the way we did it originally was that the, actually collapse that. Mm-hmm. We basically made the admin messages correspond to all of the events that would occur. So there would be an offer and a request and a send the credential. And so we had those as individual admin messages. The org book cases, we send a ton of credentials over, and we want to do it as fast as we possibly can, because for example, when we're loading, it can take, you know, the first time we did it, it took a week to issue all the credentials. We got it down to 10 hours. So we're very sensitive to that. So Nick just threw in a send message, admin message, and implemented it as it has the, it basically passes a chunk of JSON that is the data for the credential. And then inside the protocol admin message handler, it's actually processing, doing the offer, request, send, all without having to call back out to the controller. So there are optimizations that can be done with this architecture relatively easily, which I thought was really cool. So I just wanted to highlight that. Okay, stop sharing. And then Andrew's been working on some interesting stuff, and he did a demo for us this morning, and we thought it would be worth showing as well, which highlights another capability that has been created for this. Make your font a little bigger, right, Jim?
It is bigger than usual.
Okay. Okay.
See much of it.
So go ahead.
So this is kind of based on the Alice Faber interactive demo that we'd added to the agent, but this is a more automated one. So I've just got a local ledger running over here, and I just hit run demo performance. So it builds a Docker image and boots up two separate agents here. So there's, they're both instances of the IndyCat Docker image running. So we can see one startup here And then Faber, it just kind of interleaves the output from the two. And then Faber will go and publish a test schema and a corresponding credential definition. And then once that's finished, it will just start issuing a few hundred credentials over to Alice so we can test the performance of that. If I pull up Alice's admin API here, these clients are being run with extra timing enabled. So if I pull up her status endpoint, you can see the details of the timing that's been collected so far. So there's average run times for all of these calls, count, max, min, and the total time spent. And once this finishes, which will be another minute, we'll get a nice summary of where it spent all the time during that process. So I've applied a couple optimizations based on the results there. The main one was just making better use of the in-memory cache that we have at the moment so that it's not going to the non-secret storage as often. But the main bottleneck at the moment seems to be the sort of non-parallel operation of the wallet. So you can see the output there. Faber is waiting around a lot longer than Alice in this case. It's spending the most time in admin requests. Alice is spending the most time in message handlers. And from this, we can see that basically a pack message is the biggest bottleneck there. And that's just because the calls are serialized and it has to go fetch the private key every time. I can show you the code here. So we use these providers within the agent to have a sort of generic way to inject these dependencies. So when I'm injecting the base wallet implementation, the wallet provider is getting it for me, but then I wrap it in this stats provider that says, I'd like extra timing on these methods when they're called. So it's dynamically adding sort of instrumentation around those methods to get that timing. And if I don't run the agent with the timing flag enabled, then there's no overhead there. It's just not wrapping the methods. And it will just automatically time every message handler and every admin request. Oh, what are people saying in the chat there?
Nothing. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, Kyle, one of the things that we've been thinking about, there was a proposal quite a while back about the threading model, and I don't think anything's happened with it, the threading model and in the SDK, so we're going to be digging into that. We think it'll be fine that is taking that long, but we will need to be able to thread it so we can have multiple happening in parallel. So yeah, we've got to look at those. About a year ago, there was a proposal somebody put together from the Evernym team of these are ways we could optimize the threading. And so we're going to go back and look at those.
Our other option right now is just to run multiple containers against the Postgres wallet, because then you're not running into the threading locks.
Do you mean like threading in the SDK?
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha. I don't know much about that, so
yeah,
I'll have to figure out more.
There was a proposal put out about a year ago with a bunch of options, and there was a couple. There was one I think that we looked at that looked really good, but I don't think it's just ever gotten around to being worked. But yes, parallelism is what we need to be doing.
With this framework that we have here, I can just plug in an in-memory storage implementation instead of non-secrets, and it issues about 10 times faster in that case.
Okay, I think that's all we've got. Any questions other than, I think it sounds like the consensus is we're moving forward with this. We have a name for it, and we'll start moving code into a repo. I guess we could, I don't know what, if we need to do anything other than say, let's build the repo and we'll start shoving things into it. DCO is all taken care of, I think, so we should be good. Basically, this is an entire new code base from about, I don't know, January on. And so right from the start, we put all the DCO stuff in and all that stuff. So we should be good for a Hyperledger.
That will aid transition, and I will go ahead and reach out to the Hyperledger team to get that repo created.
Awesome. All right. You stop sharing.
Any party questions for the team that just presented?
All right then.
Sam, are you ready to talk about the Hype RFC stuff?
Have we lost Sam?
I just spouted brilliant stuff and it was all on mute. So Daniel, yes, do you want to talk about our stuff?
Yeah, let me just, if I could just share a screen for a second. This will be very simple. I only have like 2 minutes of stuff I want to say. All right, come on. Where's my window? Okay. So just a reminder to everybody about the life cycle of RFCs. We have this notion that you propose an RFC, then it goes from proposed status to an accepted status at a certain point, and then it goes to an adopted status. We have a fair number of RFCs that are in the proposed state. Here's a list of them. And we have a smaller number that are in the accepted state. And the difference between these states semantically is that a proposal is just something that hasn't been endorsed by the community yet, but they seem like reasonable ideas. Whereas an accepted thing is incubating on a standards track. And so in the last couple of weeks, we've been trying really hard to just capture raw content and move it into the repo, most of it in proposed state, which is why we have so many things in that first list here. A few things that we were confident the community had already kind of settled on quickly, we moved, because they were already in the indie hype repo with code building against it and seemed uncontroversial, like the encryption envelope stuff that Kyle worked on and the concept of what an agent is and stuff like that, the notion of a trust ping, we put those as accepted things. But what I wanted to say is many of the things on this list, probably a quarter of them or so, are probably a little bit more mature than the proposed status would suggest. And I want to start suggesting through the PR mechanism. So I'm going to raise PRs against a few of these and say, I propose to change the status of this RFC to accepted, meaning let's put it on a standards track. And I'd like the community to look out for those. I'll announce when I raise such PRs in the in the chat channels, and the PRs will not be merged until community members have had a chance to weigh in. So specifically, a few that I would like to move over, I think the decorators concept is relatively mature, and so is the DIDCOM concept, as high-level explainers. Those might be worth moving. I think that it's possible the AXE mechanism should move over. DIDCOM best practices or DIDCOM DIDDOC conventions. These are relatively familiar things that many people are aware of. And maybe there's some other ones. The basic message has a number of implementations that have been built. So maybe that one is worthy of moving to the accepted thing as well. So whatever those are, I'm gonna go look at those and start raising those. And of course, I'm not the only one that can do that. Anybody can raise a PR proposing to change a status, but we just haven't been doing it so far. We've just taken statuses more or less the way they fell. So we're gonna start that process. That's all I wanted to say. Any questions about that?
I believe it's described down below, but can you highlight what is the process of doing a status switch? Just a reminder. And then also, I'll start adding labels so that people can easily find which ones are in that status change.
Okay. There is somewhere. I know the verbiage that you're talking about. It says raise a PR to change the status, but I don't know where it says that anymore. I'm looking for it and I'm not finding it.
It might be in the other link document, Daniel.
In there's this
the one? Instructions to build a PR. No, not that one. The
other
one.
Oh, this one right here.
Yeah, you split this doc into two, which I think was wise.
That's right,
but
that's right. Yeah. Yeah, here we go. How to get an RFC accepted. Submit a PR that changes the status to accepted. The PR will remain open until we agree with the change, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, there's more detailed instructions. Thank you for pointing that out, Sam. There's more detailed instructions about how to deal with RFC statuses. How to create an RFC in the first place is all documented there and so forth.
And are we going to, I know I keep bringing this up, but I'm just trying to figure out the line. Are we going to discuss this on issues or on PRs?
So
I think that's a good question.
There is a comment about how we use issues. Let's see, that's back in, where's our GitHub issues link? Somewhere in here, there's a GitHub issues link. Oh, maybe not. Well, I'll just bring it up directly. I'll find the link later. Anyway, there's a discussion about this, and what it says here is RFCs that are not on the brink of changing status, we discuss through GitHub issues. So if somebody, like, let's say we have a proposed RFC and the community member says, hey, I think this RFC needs to have the following section added, or we need to cross-reference something, or I'd like to take this part out because it doesn't seem as good as the rest of it, or whatever. Those all feel to me like GitHub issue conversations. We discuss them, and once we kind of get to a point where the discussion has settled, then raise a PR against the RFC's README, saying, look, here's what I want to update. So I would prefer to kind of work the issue in issues rather than PRs, because I think closed PRs are usually relatively invisible, whereas issues, the history is maintained the same way. It's just more natural, I think, for a developer to look up old issues than it is to look up old PRs.
So I think what you're saying, Daniel, let me take a stab at this and see if this clarifies or not, is that by the time something reaches a PR status, the controversy should be mostly gone about it. Any controversy should be dealt with inside of issues. So if you're thinking of changing something significant or big or reasonable about a thing, you need to bring it up in issues and have a discussion. And then once that issue is more or less resolved, then you raise a PR that implements those things discussed in the issue. And in that way, the actual process of approving the PR is relatively rapid.
Yeah, because we didn't like on the Indie Hype repo how long many PRs were sitting in kind of a limbo status. And so I'd like it to be the case that our general community rhythm is that PRs get resolved quickly. So I agree with everything you said, Sam.
So as a general rule, would you guys say that issues are for anything that we expect to last longer than a week in discussion, and PRs are fine for shorter than that? And if we see a PR is sitting too long, we'll move it over?
I'm just throwing out a random timeline too.
I hadn't really thought about time. For me, it's all about level of controversy, right? That if it's controversial, it needs to go to issues. And I think that we should have a practice of taking PRs that are controversial and asking that they be moved to an issue and then closing the PR. And then of course can be reopened when the controversy is gone. So I think it's more or less a controversy versus not controversy thing.
That's just a fuzzy line, which is why I was looking for a time, but that's fine.
The spirit of what you said, Kyle, I think is generally true. And this line doesn't have to be that crisp. We had an interesting discussion with PR number 70, I think it was, and that's fine. I don't think we need to get so particular about the process that we get lost in the details of bureaucracy. But as a general rule, I think controversial discussions that might take a while go on to issues. PRs are mostly for ideas that are ready for rapid review instead of deep debate.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm being fair is all it comes down to.
I agree with what you said, because rapid review and deep debate are very poetic in their first initials. So
RR and DD.
Yes. So really good, Daniel, and I appreciate your work here. Also, I'd like to thank Kyle too. He's done a lot of work in maintaining the RFC repo, and that's been very helpful. Daniel and I were doing most of it before, and so it's been really nice to welcome some more people there. So I appreciate your work there. So the thing that I wanted to bring up in our conversation here, it doesn't necessarily have to be long, but Daniel has proposed some work. Oh, I'm opening the wrong thing. Daniel Hardman has proposed some work to go ahead and clear out some of the remaining Aries hypes, indie hypes that should be moved to Aries RFCs. And there's two kinds of these. One is pull requests. And so if you have a pull request that you've submitted that is Aries related, for example, here's an agent message routing one. Here's a question answer protocol. There's a credential exchange message. I think it's kind of been moved. And so what we want to do, if it's a PR, it's been moved over to an Aries RFC, we can just make a comment on the PR as the last item on the PR that says this has been superseded by here, here's the link, and then we can just close it. And that will clear out all of the non-indie related stuff as it moves over to Aries out of PRs here. The other type of thing that needs to be moved are actually things that got accepted and are actually here in the list. And a lot of these have been moved, but not all of them. Daniel Hardman has done a good job of marking his own as superseded, but I, for one, have not done all of mine. That's an item on my to-do list. But what we want to do is move everything over so that we can stop sort of dealing with this issue, and we can ignore the Aries or the Indie Hype repository for anything that happens to be Aries related. The process of doing it is a lot easier. You'll notice that we have far fewer pull requests, and we go through these relatively fast. And we have some code that helps to maintain this index file, which is also really useful. I have some ideas on how to improve this over time, including pulling the title out of the document itself so it can be a little more descriptive. I've also wondered whether it would be kind of useful to tag these by topic. For example, if you had DIDCOM-related RFCs, you could tag them with DIDCOM, and then we could sort of redundantly spit out a list by tag, which would help us to understand what the related items were sort of by topic. So there could be a credentials, or there could be DIDCOM, or other sorts of things like that. So the progress there will include, but anything that you can help move over would be very valuable. And if you have some lingering things over in the hype repository, we'd like to help move that over. And that way we can focus our discussions on new items that show up and moving the process along as Daniel has described. Are there any questions or feedback about RFCs or moving hypes to RFCs? One of the things that I would like to do in the future is Kyle did a good job of this today. His presentation was related specifically to an RFC, and he pointed to that, which makes it easy to have a conversation afterwards. Some of those don't necessarily make sense. We don't need an RFC in order to include a new code base, but that's a really useful way to have that discussion, to be able to talk about these sorts of things and make the right progress that we need. So I very much appreciate Kyle's example in doing so. I think that's Stephen. Is there anything else I should cover here besides to draw attention to moving the process along?
I don't think so. I think that covers what I was looking for. I did a bunch of work yesterday going back to Indie Hypes to see which ones had been moved, and I couldn't tell. So just some sort of indicator both of the on the hypes that have been published and the PRs moving them out, so we know what's there and what's not, would be helpful. So you've emphasized how.
Daniel, you had mentioned that you were thinking about making a similar index with some similar code over here in Indie Hype. That would actually be really handy for being able to identify things that are not yet in superseded that need to be. From an index perspective, that way we can look at it and say, "Oh, yeah, that needs to be moved or marked as moved and superseded," so that we can do that.
I'll see if I can get that done today. That I agree, that would be really helpful. By the way, can I just mention really quick, for anybody who's contributing, you should be aware that there's now a step where you have to run a unit test, and it guarantees that you've updated the index when you propose an RFC. And so just be aware of that. And if you forget to do that, no big deal. But the continuous integration that runs on the Aries RFC repo might reject your pull request because it's got an incorrect index.
And by the way, kudos to Daniel for throwing in the check links script, which you also need to run when you are ready to submit a PR. To the RFCs. It checks to make sure that all the links are actually valid across the whole code base. So that's awesome. Works really nicely.
Okay. That takes me to the end of this thing. Next up on the list is a static agent demo by Daniel Bloom. Daniel and I worked on this last week. It occurred to me that we didn't have an example of a static agent. We talked about static agents, but we never actually built one and shown it. And so we built one. And it was a good experience to kind of go through and see what was required and where there were pain points and where there were not. Daniel, hopefully, yes, he's here. He's going to give us a quick demo of that that static agent and how it works.
Okay, we can see my screen here, right?
Yes.
Cool. So yeah, as Sam said, we wrote this pretty quick last week. I put a lot of work into this README. So after the fact, if you want to go through and kind of review what I demo. It's all in the README. So this is a static agent library that we wrote in Python. It's got some examples of what exactly a static agent might be, and then how you would configure a static agent using this library. I also really would like to point out that it's up to you to secure the configuration of this static agent. We use command line arguments and environment variables, just as an example. We do not recommend that you use that mechanism in a production environment.
So it's also worth highlighting that static agents are a particular type of agent that are capable of speaking DIDCOM, but have an intentionally minimal set of requirements. And this is for a couple of reasons. One is that they might be in a really restricted environment where you can't necessarily include something like, the future libraries or libany now, or it doesn't have necessarily the resources to run a full wallet or something like that. So a static agent is one that that typically doesn't have, that doesn't create dynamic relationships with others. It has a fixed relationship with just one other agent that it uses to interact with.
Yes, thank you for that clarification. I left that out. So this static agent that we've written, as Sam said, has minimal dependencies, the fewest that we could get quickly. So it's just Python 3.6 or higher and a relatively recent version of Libsodium. We're just, as another side note, is we recognize that Libsodium of 1.0.15 is not available in Ubuntu 16.04 in the package repositories. So you have to actually build if you're on that version of Ubuntu. And we kind of recognize that that sucks, and we're looking into other ways to maybe bundle Libsodium along with the Python package or something along those lines. So yeah, I think that's enough of the README for now. I will go ahead and show you how this works. So we added a mechanism for adding a static connection to the Python reference agent, just because that was accessible and it was quick. So that's what we have running here right now with an add static connection dialog. So if I go to the command line, I have open the Aery static agent Python code here. So, and to get to this point, I've done a pip install and a pip install requirements.txt to get all those dependencies. And now I can just run the keygen script to generate keys that will be used by the static agent. So we take this DID and we plug it in here. This var key here. I missed. This is a label, which can be anything in this case. So, and then the first example that we're going to run does not actually include an endpoint. It doesn't have an inbound mechanism set up for the static agent. So we can just leave it blank for now. And then it comes back with the information that the full agent will be using for this connection. So now we can pull up this. We set the endpoint to the endpoint of our full agent. We set the endpoint key to the very key that I just copied. And that's all we need from here. So then we have to configure my public key, which is the public key of the static agent. Oops. And also the private key.
So the goal of this, while he's doing this, is that right now, if you're going to call an API, you're probably going to have keys that you have to use to call it. I'm thinking of like AWS, for example, where you have like a public key and a private key. And this is a little bit more involved than that, but along the same vein, meaning here's configuration values that you have to have in place in order to call the API.
Right. So I've run the script. It's exited successfully. Doesn't look like it's done too much from this side, but if we go here to the reference agent and we open up our connection, we can see that it has sent us a fully encrypted and properly packaged message, just saying that the cron script has been B-E-N executed. So yeah, I'm gonna pull open that example just to show how little is needed to do this. So the vast majority of this is just the configuration. And then this is how one would open a static agent connection with the full agent and then send a message to that full agent. So this is a super basic example, but it also just really highlights like how simple this is. I'm very excited about this. But the other part that I'm even more excited about is the web server example that we have also included in this repository. So the static agent is completely decoupled from an inbound transport mechanism, meaning you can set up whatever you like to receive messages for the static agent. it's not, the library itself is not opinionated about how you ought to do that. So this is an example of using the AIO HTTP web server library for Python. So as in the last example, we created a static agent connection so we can send messages to the full agent. And then we can set up an inbound agent message handler that the static agent will use to process messages received of that type. So to do that, you just use the route decorator on the static agent connection. Then messages of this type will be routed to this handler. Then this is the AIO HTTP handler. And all it does is just pulls the post body out of the message and then puts it on the handling queue, basically, for the static agent connection, which will trigger this handler being executed.
And this the cool part here is that from 45 to 52 is just the AIO web server, which means that you could pretty easily add this to any existing web server if you wanted it to be able to handle DIDCOM messages as a static agent. So if you have an existing web property, for example, this would be really easy to integrate with.
I'm having the same reaction to this demo that I had the very first time I actually saw DIDs exchanged and a proof flow between two agents. It was like this demo that was like super simple. It looked super simple on the outside, but I was freaking out because of how many moving parts I knew were working underneath. This is like so awesome. For those of you who don't, you know, haven't lived through all of this, this may not, the coolness may not be obvious, but that's what makes it so cool, is that it seems so simple. Wow, this is awesome.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. I especially like just the decorator to just get the agent messages to the handler. I'm really excited about that part. So, yeah, I don't know that I have anything else to say.
Hey, you want to show this one running?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can do that. So since we already have all of this.
This is the first time I know of that we've ever had an example of an agent that's not the big fancy kind of agent, but is we've said for a year, oh, yeah, cronjobs could be an agent. That's a piece of cake. I've actually written a couple of demos that are sort of approaching it down in the indie SDK stuff. But this is like the first time we've had a completely packaged set of code to back up that assertion. And now when people show up in the environment, they can say, well, what kind of agent am I trying to write? Well, I'm trying to write the big fancy cloud one. Great. We hook them up with IndyCat or other language framework types of things. But if they say, well, I just want to talk DIDCOM from my cron job, this is exactly what to point them at.
Thanks for filling the time as I change the configuration. So since the reference agent already has a connection with the other details, I'm going to have to set up a new one so I can set the endpoint on the reference agent for this static agent.
If you had, while he's still configuring, if you had a static agent in your enterprise that was talking with a fuller agent, this is the task that like an IT administrator would do, similar to plugging in API keys or other authentication mechanisms. So they would do this infrequently, but this is how they could go and set this up. With scripts to generate keys and things like that, we end up with a connection that is still secure, but is only secure, of course, as your configuration management practices, just the way other APIs still work.
Yeah, the copying and pasting from the command line is a little fiddly.
It is, but the reason I like this demo as opposed to the cron one is it actually shows how to design something that's more interactive, right? You can have a static agent that definitely interacts in back and forth with you, and I like that. And so that's the cool part about this demo, even though it takes a second to put this back up.
OK. Okay.
While you're fiddling, can I raise an idea that just popped in my head? You've named your repo Aries-static-agent-python. And we just had a discussion about IndyCat going to Aries-agent-python. I wonder if maybe the better names for these would be Aries-cloud-python for IndyCat and Aries-static-python for the other one. So take the word agent out, but still keep a middle word, but use it to distinguish what type of agent we're talking about. That would allow us to have something like Aries-mobile-something as a parallel.
Yeah, we've been talking about that as well, and we like that as a concept because, we agree that agent is not very descriptive. We feel like it's redundant, but we also see why, but I think cloud makes more sense.
I actually really like this one because it sets the expectation around security differences.
Okay, while we're talking, you did the demo, Daniel, but it's set up to be an autoresponder in this particular case, right?
Yes, yeah, we're getting some pretty crazy feedback, so I'm kind of hoping that goes away.
Steven, is that your mic, I think?
It's Steven Curran's when he's unmuted. He's taking care of it though.
Okay, cool. So yeah, so the web server example in the repository right now is just an echo script basically. It just tells you what you said to it. So we can say something else and it just responds immediately with that response.
I see this discovered protocols here with send query. Is that discovering for a specific thing or does it just, how does this work?
So that's the protocol or I guess renamed to feature discovery protocol. This is just on the reference agent. The static agent that we're running against doesn't actually support that, so it raised a not registered or no registered route exception on that message that it received. But that's the feature discovery.
It actually could. That would be interesting, Daniel. Is we could have it automatically report the protocols that you register.
Yeah.
And so we could support that. We just didn't get there in our demo time. Part of the related question here is about where this belongs. It's right now sitting in my GitHub repo is where we're working off of it. But the intention, of course, is to put it in an Aries repo. Daniel Hardman's raised the feedback that calling it something other than static agent might be useful. We could call it having agent in there may be useful, but in order to differentiate from different types of agents. Are there any other objections to including this in the code base in an Aries repo?
Don't call mine and my idea an objection.
Yours was a clarification.
I want it in there as soon as possible.
I don't hear any objections, and I didn't anticipate any. But is there what name should it be under? Your proposal was pretty good, Daniel, but I forgot what it was.
I just take the word agent out and just have the three words be Aries-static-python. Where the middle word is just a category of agent.
Well, the middle word right now is a category of asset, not just of agent. For example, you have Aries SDK Python, and I worry that not including agent will not help differentiate it from things like SDK or other assets, other artifacts that are part of the Aries project.
Okay, it was just off the top of my head observation.
No. No, I like it. And I think that calling it not Python as far as the IndyCat converted name, we had talked about it being Python agent, but that sort of implies that there's only ever one Python agent. And now we've got two. We've got a static one and a cloud one. But I wonder if calling it something like cloud agent and static agent would be a little bit more clear. I don't really want to go to a fourth level where it would be Aries agent static Python. That seems a little deep, but maybe including just like cloud agent and static agent might be enough of a differentiator. Thoughts?
I think this makes sense. What I'm thinking about right now is I could build an edge agent technically for my computer by taking the IndyCAD agent, running that as a web server on my computer, and then using the static agent as a user interface for it. And then that would be Aries Edge. Now, I'm not going to be able to go do this right now. But that's what I'm thinking is that would be the follow in line with that thinking as well. So we have static, edge, and cloud.
Yes. We also have mobile agents as well, although we're maybe not likely to write one in Python, but that'll certainly happen when it comes to like Java or, you know, some of the other common languages that can happen. We've got code in C# and Xamarin, and you could do many things with C#, not just that. So I think being more descriptive with the IndyCAD agent, like cloud agent, might be a really good example of what we create that repo as, in that way it doesn't conflict there. And it sounds like we can just use the static agent as a way to bring that over. So we can just probably use that same name unless someone's got a better one. But yes, you could definitely use this as a way to talk to really any full agent in order to make that happen. Actually, technically, I think you could even talk static agent to static agent, though certainly you lose some of the advantages of the larger ecosystem there. But excellent. That is, I believe, the end of what we had scheduled to talk about today. Did we actually get to everything we planned to talk about? Someone should write that down because it doesn't happen all that often. Are there, at this point, we have 5 minutes for open discussion. Is there anything that anyone wants to bring up?
Relevant to repos, there's also the Hyperledger Labs. And so what I'm thinking about is we may get to the point where we start to scare some of the other projects because we're creating so many repositories. And that is a functionality that we may want to take into consideration is, can we put these things in Hyperledger Labs?
So what is Hyperledger? Educate us, Kyle. What's Hyperledger Labs and how would this fit?
Go to GitHub / Hyperledger Labs, and you'll kind of see the example. It's Hyperledger-Labs. So these are essentially projects that are often built on top of other projects inside of Hyperledger. So for example, the Cordentity stuff is in here. And it just needs one maintainer in order to do it. And so they're just example projects and things of that nature to be able to host things without having to put everything inside of Hyperledger. And so what I was thinking is, you know, for example, the static agent is a good example, and the CAD agent are good examples. Those make examples for living in Hyperledger. But, you know, maybe a mobile agent makes more sense to exist in Hyperledger Labs. I don't know how to draw the line. I just wanted to throw the idea out there.
That is a good one. It had occurred to me that we were creating repositories like nobody's business. The problem that we observed over in India is we started putting, like, the India agent repository actually has like three things in it, and that makes it really awkward for a CI/CD pipeline. And so if we have a static agent, for example, it would be nice to be able to publish an asset out of that, which is in fact the Python library that makes it work. This could be an alternative there, although we still might end up creating a whole lot of things here. So these things sort of seem like it could be stuff that doesn't directly relate to an existing Hyperledger project. Cord Identity is kind of like a bridge between Identity and Corda, right? So it's kind of an outside thing where this is more of a factor of the Aries project, I'd say. But that is a good thing to point out.
Yeah, this is more of like a sub-project from my understanding. And so that's where I'm not really sure. And the TSC, I think, is discussing these types of things right now. So it may be something to run past Nathan.
Okay. I'll ask him before we do any promotion there, but I would definitely like to get it into a Hyperledger or Hyperledger Labs code repository.
And just for clarification, I think the IndyCAD stuff actually does belong in Hyperledger.
I concur.
Of high enough quality that it
deserves it, that status.
And the static agent, maybe. It depends a little bit on how we sort of view the creation of tools surrounding the Aries ecosystem, right? This is one tool in the ecosystem. And I don't want to exclude it necessarily, but I also think that the really small ones may not have quite the same home as the larger projects. We don't want to hide the larger projects behind the smaller ones.
So, but I just have a quick question before we end. Going back to the messaging for the static agent with the at type, is that a fully formed DID URL that's resolvable?
That's the idea, and that's actually in the, we have an RFC that talks about that, if I could find it here really quick. It should be message types. It is resolvable, but not to a schema. It's resolvable to developer documentation. So this needs a slight update. There has been there are matrix parameters involved now that weren't at the time that this was originally written. So I've been kind of waiting for all of those PRs to be accepted into the DID spec before we go touch all of these and update the syntax. But yes, this is designed to be a resolvable URL that resolves to developer documentation about the protocol.
All right, and the at type is that JSON-LD, then, but without a context.
It's so in JSON-LD, you can specify the context and the type separately, or lacking a context, you can provide a fully formed type, even in the presence of a context. And so this is JSON-LD compliant as far as specifying a type. We also have a separate RFC on how we are JSON or how we are RFC. Or JSON-LD compliant without whilst trying to avoid all of the baggage of JSON-LD. That's 47 right here. So type and ID are the at typed ones that fit into the JSON-LD stuff, and then all the other decorators that we use are use a tilde to avoid conflicting with anything JSON-LD related.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Can I backhold a bit to the topic about the GitHub and the repositories?
Sure.
Because I would like to clarify, do we really have all the maintainers of all the repositories which were created in Aries within Hyperledger? Because I see Aries as a something which is much bigger, which is going outside Hyperledger as well. There's a lot of projects that actually try to use some components out of it or would like to try to use it. And I believe that a lot of different languages like, you know, Kotlin, Swift, .NET, whatever, people will just implement in their own spaces and community will build those implementation. And within Aries, there will be just reference implementation in like one, maybe two languages. I don't know how many maintainers we have available which will really maintain it under Hyperledger brand.
So people are always welcome to develop anything related under their own. And we have not yet, but we did over in Indy, but we haven't replicated over here in Aries yet, a link to other code repositories. But we will be doing so so that people can find libraries and other related projects. I don't believe you have to be a member of Hyperledger in order to be a maintainer on a Hyperledger project either. And so Hyperledger is an open development organization. You do not have to be a member to attend meetings or to contribute code or anything else, as long as you follow the same, you know, the certificate of origin guidelines, which are pretty easy to follow. So there's a couple of responses there. One is everyone's absolutely welcome to do work anywhere, and we will get a directory up for related repositories and projects that exist outside of Hyperledger repositories. It's also, if you desire, very easy to become a maintainer inside of Hyperledger with very little commitment and effort in the long term, except to the code that you are committing to be a maintainer of.
I think it would be awesome if we had a bunch of people wanting to be contributors and they weren't part of Hyperledger. The phrase part of Hyperledger is really ambiguous anyway. They don't have to belong to some organization that pays Hyperledger dues. By showing up and editing or maintaining code in a Hyperledger repo, they are sort of becoming quote unquote part of Hyperledger in some sense, but they
the Hyperledger community for sure.
Right. But they don't have to really have any affiliation or connection to Hyperledger at all, other than the DCO stuff that you already said.
Right. The developer certificate of origin is the only requirement for code contributions.
Yeah, I mean, that's obvious. I just was wondering if that's actually intended approach that, let's say someone will came up with the idea, okay, I would like to implement, I don't know, agent in Prolog or something, right? And he will start, there will be a repo created for him. He will start a bunch of code, and then basically he will just abandon the project, and there will be just some pieces around which won't be maintained and won't be active. So I'm just wondering what kind of projects we want to put within the Ares or under the umbrella of Hyperledgers, some of those which will be really maintained and will be active, or anything. Whoever will came up with the idea will just create a repo for him.
I think there needs to be a standard bar, and I think the TSC is working on setting that standard bar.
Yes. So that's a good question, but it's sort of a Hyperledger level question. One of the benefits of putting it in Hyperledger is that I think it might be easier for someone over to take over maintainership if someone should have to retire from the project. And so if it is a valuable community project, then I think that that's valuable. I also don't necessarily think that if it is ever created as a repo, it will always maintain as a repo. So if it falls out of use or something else, then I think that can go away with very little problem.
Yeah, because for me as well is that if something is there, then people could have a kind of feeling that it's branded by Hyperledger and Hyperledger is taking care of that repository. If, for example, someone will do a bad implementation with something with the bad code and stuff, some people could complain directly to the community, even though that it was not like intended to be that bad or something. So I'm just wondering, we are not able to track each language and each implementation and stamp it as a Hyperledger thing. That's what I'm wondering.
And that's an excellent question for those standards that Kyle was referring to. So we'll have to follow up on that and see if we can learn more about the standards that Hyperledger is deciding on. But thank you for bringing that up. Okay, we are over time. We appreciate you coming. Please come next time and bring a friend. And we will see you all next week on the Ares call. And please take any further conversations or things that you thought about here to the channels on Rocket Chat and to issues on GitHub for RFCs. And thanks all.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.